Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, the series all about radio, broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. We're a week earlier than usual due to the June bank holiday, but we've a packed programme as ever. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, podcasting, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on this edition of Wireless, Community Radio celebrates 40 years in Kilkenny City. We bring you a series of interviews from the recent Hearsay International Audio Festival in Limerick and a look back at one of our highlights from this season of Wireless.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Forty years of community radio in Kilkenny City was marked recently by Community Radio Kilkenny City. Our reporter Ralph McGarry called into the station to speak with manager Declan Gibbons, to have a nose around the studios, to discover the backstory to the station and to hear about its future plans. Ralph started by asking Declan to tell him about how they marked the occasion of 40 years of community radio in Kilkenny.
1979 was the year of if not revolution, certainly a lot of stirrings around the country in communities that got radio going. At the time it was called pirate radio, but there was no licensing, I suppose, for anything other than RTE at the time. And in Kilkenny, a group got together and they started Kilkenny Community Radio, KCR, at the time. And I think RTE might have had something. I don't know if here, but I'm aware of RTE having a roadshow going around in 79, encouraging people to kind of get interested in radio. And they might have been sorry they did, because what happened was a lot of these groups sprung up. And in Kilkenny, a number of people founded this, a man called Michael Minogue, and he met up with a priest called Father Jerry Joyce and a few others. And they decided to set up a pirate radio, and as they said, it just wasn't licensed, rather than that it was illegal, because there was no license for it. And it proved very popular, and it went on for 10 years, and that was 40 years ago. So we thought 40 years this year, our station is has the same bloodlines, if you like, and it's come from the same the people that set that up, and we thought it was important to mark that. So it's 40 years since the start of community radio. We are the community radio in Kilkenny, and it was great. We got a lot of people together who were involved either in the very earliest days or over the years, and it was a brilliant occasion.
So what's the radio station here doing to celebrate that?
Well, what we've done is we've extended our schedule. In this iteration, Community Radio Kilkenny City got its licence in September of 2017 and began broadcasting on the 27th of October of that year, 73 hours a week. And it's gone down well, but obviously there's only so many hours in the day, and that we were limited in our reach. So it's gone well. We've attracted more volunteers. The community has gotten involved. We've lots of groups getting involved, and they seem to be responding by kind of saying, when are you going to be on longer? So what we've decided to do is to extend our schedule, and we've added 24 hours per week, 6 hours per day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, and we've rejigged our schedule. So we've just relaunched that. And then in tandem with that, we're having an actual event to mark the 40 years out at the venue where the original pirate radio studio was from 1979. And we're going out there on the 31st of May. And that's a significant day around here, because Kilkenny is associated with the Cats Laughs Festival. And that's the start of that holiday weekend. So we think it's going to be very, very significant. There's going to be a lot of people go and attend that. It'll be open to the public, but also we're encouraging anyone who's involved in the foundations of community radio and anyone who's been involved over the years in the radios in Kilkenny and in community. We want them to come out. We're going to have music from musicians who took part during the pirate days and during the early days, all of whom, like myself, I wasn't in the beginnings of it, but all of whom are, I suppose, have a bit more miles on the clock than we did back then. So musicians playing that music. We'll have a little bit, we'll have recordings from back in those days, which are brilliant for nostalgia. And then we'll have a number of the people who were around in the early days, and we'll talk to them on the day as well. So it's going to be fun. And some of the original advertisers have actually come on board as well. So that's kind of exciting.
It is. And will people from out, how will people from outside the city be able to listen to this? Will you be podcasting it or something like that?
Well, it'll be broadcast on our own frequency, which is 88.7 FM and for Kilkenny City and environs. Also, we're online on communityradiokilkennycity.ie, so you can listen live on that. And where the studio is it's actually within our area, because I wasn't involved back in those days, I was afraid that the studio was outside of our area, but it's not in Ballycallan, it's on the Ballycallan Road, and it's within our area, so it's not too far to go out. And we think it's going to be popular, and the weather's going to be a bit better as well.
You know that.
Yeah, as I said, I visited the old Ballycallan Road studios in January, on a very cold day in January, and we were outside, and then we went inside to the old studio, which is up in an attic,
okay,
and indoors. But there's no question but that it was colder than it was outside. Whatever it is, and I've been in buildings like that before that are colder than outside. I'd stayed in a house in college once where there used to be ice on the inside. But it just made the hair stand up on me, and not just from the cold that day. But I think, you know, it's part of something, and you feel that you're part of something that's much bigger. And I think people have really... When we held an event to commemorate the 40 years recently, lots of people came, and I think it's the people who didn't come or couldn't make it, they're definitely going to be out there on the 31st, and it's brilliant. But we're looking forward as well, as I said, because I think, you know, there's a huge appetite in this area for community radio, and hopefully we will feed it.
So what has 40 years of community radio done for Kilkenny City?
Fair question. It has, I think... You know, it might sound like a cliche, but given it its own voice, a man said to me in an outlying village of Kilkenny some years ago, he said, there could be 20 telegraph poles down between here and Kilkenny City, he said, and nobody on RTE would care about it. And that was a fair point. So it's given it its voice, but not just, and obviously, and I've been involved in commercial radio, and commercial radio has its own job to do, and it does a fine job, as does RTE. But I think community radio gives huge access to people and to groups. And we're all familiar with groups that are good at putting their message out, but there are lots of groups that are just doing stuff, and they don't have time to tell people about it. So if you tell them and create this facility whereby they can spread their words, just even about the events that they're holding, they can grow from that. And then you tell them, well, you can come in and we can interview you and talk about what you do, and then we can give you an opportunity to make a programme. And then suddenly people like me who come in as a hobby, and you learn a skill, and then you have a career out of it. Like, you know, it's had a huge impact on an awful lot of people's lives, and also, as I said, on the groups. But what I think it's really good at is kind of the glue that pulls a lot of things together, because there's loads of good things happening in community in isolation, and I think we help to pull them all together, and I think it's definitely achieved that here.
The station here has only been on air 18 months, nearly 2 years, but you've already increased your airtime quite substantially. How have you been able to do that?
Well, when the board put in their application to the Broadcasting Authority, they applied for 73 hours, and that was over a period of temporary licences. They had run Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays, 9 a.m. to midnight, which is pretty demanding. That's 45 hours of broadcasting. And then in our most recent 100-day license, we added another day and made it Monday, 12 until 7 p.m., 12 p.m. till 7 p.m., just 7 hours a day. So they hatched the idea that we do 7 hours a day for the 4 days that weren't the weekend, if you like. And I think that was the right thing to do, because it made sure that whatever was rolled out was sustainable. And we didn't know how it was going to go when we ran that temporary license. But the Monday seemed to go well, and people seemed to like it. So we rolled out something similar for our 10-year license, and that has gone well. But there's definitely been an appetite, and people are saying it to us. They're saying it to our salespeople. They're saying it to our people who are out doing programmes. why aren't you on longer? We weren't on until midday and we weren't on after 7 p.m. Monday to Thursday. So we've kind of responded to that, and it took a long time. Well, I suppose half of the time we've been on air, we've probably been trying to extend our schedule, and we've obviously had to get the volunteers. And I think the fact that it's a quality product that we're putting out has attracted volunteers. They want to be part of it. And it's, you know, because I don't believe that community radio should be poor quality radio, and I don't believe it necessarily is. We've got some fantastic, highly experienced people here. We've got lots of new people here as well who are learning and who are doing brilliant stuff. So I think it's that combination. So we've gone up from having, when we started, about 55 volunteers to about 106, 110 volunteers. And so that's substantial growth. And we have enough to be able to person that schedule. But I think if there's dropouts, obviously, as in if somebody's away, it's going to be much harder, because you're going to have nearly 100 hours of broadcasting that needs to be, you know, back up and covered. But we can build. I think there'll be, won't too many people take holidays in the first couple of months. So we will be able to build. But that's how we've done it, because I think it was quality, and we didn't want to increase our hours and put on rubbish, because people won't stay and listen to rubbish.
Yeah. The previous licensed station here in Kilkenny City was a commercial station, but I think, would it be fair to say that it had a community ethos? And it's long since gone, but do you think that there's an unmet demand, you know, that's facilitated Community Radio Kilkenny City?
I do think that, definitely. And there still is a commercial radio for Kilkenny and Carlow, which is KCLR 96FM, and they have a commercial license for the two stations. But definitely, I mean, in the old station, that's when I got involved as a volunteer. And at the time, even though it had a commercial license, 50% of its output was broadcast by volunteers. And the ethos was very much community. So I think that's where that heritage is there. And you're right, that's where that, you know, that linkage, that want is there. And I think that we are definitely responding to a need. And I think while it was a huge challenge for the board to win this license, the fact that heritage was there, it was easy enough to demonstrate to the BAI, albeit it took many, many years to actually get it across the line.
We are currently in the studios in Hebron Industrial Park, and this was the studios of the site of the previous Radio Kilkenny. Do you think that having this facility at your disposal has helped the development of community radio here?
Oh, of course, it's fantastic asset. We're really lucky to have this building and somewhere to come. There was somewhere for the board to hold meetings and over the years when there was nothing else, only a board and meetings. And then there's the studios. They're quite dated. They are back from 1998 at this stage, but they're still a fantastic asset to have. And yeah, I think there's no question that it would have been much more difficult if you had to start with a greenfield.
Do you do any outside broadcast? Do you go out into the city, into the shopping centres or the schools? Or we're also not far from Nolan Park. Do you do any outside broadcast for sports?
Yeah, we do all of that. And I think sport would probably be the strongest type of programming that we have. We have a very committed and active sports team, as in their people who are all involved in their various sports. And so that's very strong. And we do coverage. We don't tend to do full commentaries, but we do a lot of coverage of events and reports from obviously hurling is number one in this area, but from a range of other sports as well. And we were part of the Big Hello, as was every other community radio station in the country. We covered lots of community events. But yeah, we do a lot of outside broadcasts. We go to community events, cover things like, for instance, St. John's School. Now, later this month, we'll have their annual open day at O'Loughlin Gales GA Club, and we'll go up and do an outside broadcast from that. And we do a number of them, and then we do a few commercial outside broadcasts as well. So it's a great way of getting out in the community, getting people involved. We've done outside broadcasts from, say, family resource centres, all that type of thing. And also it's a good way of generating a few bob as well.
Not to pitch one station against another, but what do you think is different with Community Radio Kilkenny City vis-a-vis other community stations? What are you doing different?
Not sure, really. I'm not too sure because I see lots of other stations. We're obviously at an early stage in our development, so there's lots of other stations are in train or have got regular QQI training programs going. Lots of them are into sound and vision. We haven't got into that yet, but I think that we have the potential to grow fairly quickly, as you've seen what's happened. So we're not necessarily, you know, a model for anywhere else, but we hope to get there, that come November we'll get involved in sound and vision. And over time, we have done a few training courses, but it's not something, we simply don't have the people resources at the moment to get that type of thing up and running. We want to do lots more in schools. So I think a lot of the established stations are doing all that stuff, and we want to get there too.
And also notice that you have your own branded van. That must be great to be able to get the word out that you're here.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. And that's a vote of confidence too from a local company, Michael Ling Motors, who are very strong in sport. And they are one of our sport sponsors. And we have a deal with them whereby they supply us with that vehicle. And it's great. It's brilliant branding to go out and about, because really, I think the biggest challenge, apart from actually getting the station up and running, is to let people know. And every week I still meet people who haven't heard of the station, that are, you know, even in a relatively small area. And so rather than being disappointed by that, I'm delighted, because once we've had that conversation, well, then they know about it. But everything we can do to make people aware is positive. And I think the van is a fantastic asset that way.
And will you be measuring that at some stage, listenership or outreach of how effective you are?
Yeah, as you know, the community sector doesn't have JNLR as such, which operates in commercial and for RTE. But there is a thing called the Community Broadcasting Support Scheme, whereby the Broadcasting Authority will fund stations to do an evaluation survey. And we recently did one. We did it. It was done over the course of February and March by an external consultant, and sanctioned, if you like, by the BAI. And that brought us back some very impressive numbers. It showed, and we were shocked. If you take our core area, is 26,000 odd people of Kilkenny City, in a broader area of say 35,000 to 40,000 in the environs. So we had a sample of 260, which is 1% of the city, if you like. It's a huge sample. As if you take the Ipsos surveys for the whole country, there's a sample of 1,000. So of that, we were shocked to find that 77% of people were aware of us. And of those 77, 69% are listening every week. And now, you know, JNLR will provide you with a much more detailed survey. But that was very impressive. That says to us that more than half of the people in Kilkenny are listening at some stage every week. A third of people have the station tuned in as their first preference on their car. And that's remarkable after 18 months. And it's great to have solid, externally produced data that shows that. So I suppose that has helped to give us the impetus to push on with this new schedule.
Yeah, it is. It's gratifying. And as you know, community radio isn't all about, you know, listenership. It's about access to the
yes.
broadcast.
Yeah.
And it's obvious that that's happened in terms of the amount of volunteers that you have. But that's on the kind of the population side. How important is it to have the backing of the business in the city?
Well, it's really important. But I think any community radio, I believe there's three levels. And this is just what I think, might be right, might be wrong. There's that level where people think it's nice. It's a nice idea. My granny might listen to it. That kind of thing. And that's fine. But I think you've got to get to the stage where it's relevant. So in other words, the station is involved in things that are going on, and things that are going on get in touch with the station. And then ultimately you want to get to the stage where you're essential. So in other words, if you're not tuned into the station, you're missing out on something. And I think if we're relevant, and I think we definitely are, well then businesses will respond to that. And they'll also know. And I think, take away any surveys, business people with their ears to the ground will know if anybody is talking about the station. And I think that, so that's, I think, yes, it's necessary and it's essential for a station like ours anyway. But I think it's a product of what we do. If we do something that people actually want and something that's different, because I think it's our difference. And having been involved in commercial radio as well, you know, sometimes I would question myself whether, you know, well, Jeannie, is it all just about access and diversity? It actually is, because the scope that you can do and what you can provide for people, it's phenomenal, and it's liberating, but it's also it also can be rewarding.
And in your view, what do you think the future is for community radio in Ireland over the next number of years?
Nice small question there. Future, I hope it's going to grow. I think there's a need for us that is greater than ever, and that is a response to the fact that there are, while you've social media, you've all of those platforms, you have loads and loads of commercial radio stations, I think your sources of news are probably reducing rather than increasing. A lot of the forms of information are coming from a small number of sources and just coming through different channels to get to the end user, but it's largely the same information that's coming through. I think community radio has, I don't think it, I know it, because the Broadcasting Authority have told us that over the past two decades, community radio has been the best form of providing media literacy. So in other words, making people aware of what's in the media and making them able to distill the message better. And I think so the potential there for growth is huge. I'm not saying there's going to be 60 community radio stations. At the moment, we've 21 full-time stations. There's approximately 15 in various phases of development. I'm not sure if all of those will necessarily get to the full stage, but I would hope that it's going to grow. For instance, in Leinster, outside of Dublin, there are only three full-time community stations. You'd think surely there is scope for an expansion. And in places like Limerick, Mayo, Galway, there's a substantial presence. Donegal, it's very popular as well, and they would all seem to be places that where community is strong. And I wonder, you know, perhaps one responds to the other, or one benefits from the other.
And those Western Seaboard counties you mentioned have a very strong diaspora. You broadcast online. Do you have any connections with the Kilkenny diaspora? Have you noticed anything like that?
We do, yeah, and there'll be a few particularly specific programmes that that address that. We have a particular programme, a Rhythm and Roots programme, that would have a strong listenership in the US. But then we've another programme for older people that's called Radio Active, and it would have had a number of features and visited places like the Kilkenny Association in Manchester, and I suppose it builds links there, and those people then listen in as well. Maybe not in huge numbers, but certainly we're aware of that, and I think we have to address that more as we go on. But at the moment, we're just, you know, just trying to find our feet and get all four legs stable on the ground, if you like.
Declan Gibbons, manager of Kilkenny City Community Radio, speaking to Ralph McGarry about the history and future plans of the station, which celebrates 40 years of community radio in Kilkenny next week. For more information, keep an eye on communityradiokilkennycity.ie.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Last month, we brought you a taste of the fourth Hearsay International Audio Festival, which was held recently in Kilfinan in County Limerick. For 4 days and nights in April, the mountain village was taken over by national and international award-winning contributors working with all types of creative audio, including radio features, sound art, music and audio fiction. Our reporter Brian Green was in Kilfinan for Wireless and brings us this report.
We're with Jason Phipps, Commissioning Editor for Content and Podcasts at BBC Sounds and across the BBC. Tell us a bit about what your job entails and what you're looking for.
Well, I myself, I've worked in podcasts for the last sort of 14 years, and I was a typical kind of radio producer in BBC Local Radio and World Service, and I left in around 2006 because I could see the podcasting kind of revolution happen, and went off and worked in various guises for different people, and then worked mostly then for The Guardian. The Guardian has been a real home for podcasts over the last decade or more. And then I became head of audio at the Guardian for the last sort of 4 or 5 years. And then about a year ago, just under a year ago, I moved over to this role that I'm in now because effectively the BBC, I left the BBC because podcasting wasn't going to happen at the BBC because of regulation. And that has opened up now, and the BBC are fully kind of engaged with podcasting as a distinct form. Most people probably listen to BBC Contact as a podcast, you know, but it's radio content going out on an RSS feed, where I've come to this job and this role saying that podcast has its own specific kind of language, its own grammar. It's born of radio, but it's evolved into something that's quite different.
BBC Sounds launched on November 1st, 2018. How has its birth been?
So the BBC Sounds app is a very ambitious kind of play by the BBC to have a destination where you can discover all sorts of audio, right? So, you know, it's the biggest platform since the iPlayer. So for video or for TV content, you'll go to the iPlayer. For radio, for podcasts, for music, you'll go to Sounds, right? And my role in that team is to look at what's missing for younger audiences in that kind of entertaining, intelligent speech area. Because traditionally, youth audiences in the BBC have been treated in this way, which is as long as you do pop music and music culture, you kind of cover the bases, okay, with some lifestyle and some health education around it. That's what Radio 1 is, basically. It's a pop station. And then with Radio 4, the audiences have tended to skew older, and Radio 5 Live. So when you look in the app at that kind of content and you sort of segment all that content, all those radio shows, and put it in the Sounds app, you start to see that there's a kind of lack of speech content for younger people. And that's what podcasts have been doing independently outside of the BBC and outside of public service broadcasters. Young, creative people have just picked up mics and made podcasts to have conversations that are relevant to them. We're trying to capture that, basically. And with our own BBC public service values, we're trying to create kind of compelling new content in that space for the Sounds app and for BBC listeners.
Do you fund them yourself, or can people be funded under the Audio Content Fund? Or there's a lot of money there for youth radio?
No, we have our own specific funds, yeah. We have a bit of a thing called, we call a kind of double tick, where we can co-fund with other networks if we have a real sort of objective in mind. So I've already kind of kicked off some projects where Five Live and myself would co-fund something that, you know, is a good podcast proposition for that radio network. And BBC Children's, I'm working with BBC Children's because we're looking at drama for young people, where we would kind of help each other and we can co-fund. But I centrally have a kind of fund specifically for podcasts.
And are you inundated with new applications or for people submitting ideas?
I mean, informally, yeah, because I always say that, you know, everyone used to have an idea for a novel and now everybody has an idea for a podcast. But that's great, that try to capture that kind of energy. And we have a formal way you can pitch ideas. And yeah, we've had, I think, in the region of about 200 proposals in the last sort of 7 months. But by the time you get to that sort of point where you're formally pitching to me, the idea is usually resolved. We've had a few conversations and we know roughly where we're heading. So people don't waste a lot of time. And then there's just like very, like you said, kind of DIY organic pitches that come into us. Yeah, we have those conversations as well, but we're trying to encourage those people to develop and take what they're doing on their own, you know, like basically kickstarting their own podcasts, trying to figure out how they can kind of professionalize to come in and take money from us. The great thing about podcasting is, unlike where a lot of radio shows, if you didn't get commissioned by the BBC, you wouldn't be able to get your show up and out unless you're in a local radio station or a hospital radio. The great thing about podcasting is if you've got a great idea, right? I mean, I'll give you an example. Cinemile, which is a great cinema review show podcast by two Irish folk actually in London, that literally was, they were using their iPhone to record the conversation on the way to the cinema, and then on the way back, right? They didn't need a commissioner to do that. It was a successful podcast. They won the British Podcast Awards about 2 years ago, Best New Podcast. You can do it on your own, right? So when you'd come to someone like me, you want to do something slightly different. You want a bit more resource, a bit more money to do something that fits with what the BBC is trying to do in that space. So we have public service values, public service objectives. We're trying to not replicate too much in the market. We're trying to make sure that it's got sort of useful, educative, socially useful sort of content at the heart of it, and all the usual things why BBC will sort of spend money on content.
And last question from me. Podcasting has had two major spikes in media interest in 2006 and in 2012 with Serial. But despite those big spikes of media interest and kind of interest in the general public, it has continued to grow at a very steady rate. Is that a good thing for podcasting?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's awesome. I mean, like I said, I think I spoke earlier in this talk, which is that, you know, the on-demand revolution, yeah, that happened in TV about 20 years ago, and it's happening in audio now. And what it does is, one, it gives you new ways for radio creatives to make different kinds of audio for different audiences, but it also allows very sort of organic DIY young entrants into the market to not have to go through radio stations. They can just literally go direct to their audiences. So you have this other culture growing. So you get podcasts like My Dad Wrote a Porno, or in Germany, one of my favorite German podcasts is a great podcast called Tonbank Berlin, which is just a very simple conversation between two friends in Berlin about the favorite places they like to sit and talk. And it's just basically conversation, but it's compelling. They're very funny. That kind of organic, very digital way of discovering new content for new voices to make new content, that's what's happening at the moment, and that's a wholly good thing, yeah?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's great to talk to you.
Flirt FM at the Hearsay Audio Arts Festival 2019. I'm with Neil Sandell, and you are an independent podcast producer, and you've worked in radio with the CBC, and you gave a lovely talk about introductions and how to grab people. The title of it was Pringles or the Full Irish.
Yes.
And 20 minutes into your talk, the taste was still on my lips as I licked my lips, because it was lasting. And the message there, I suppose, was that you want to whet people's appetite when you're starting an audio story. Is that it?
Yeah, exactly. The idea, especially for the first few minutes, is to draw people in. You want to get them intrigued, hooked on your story. You don't want to bore them. You don't want to confuse them. It's like that feeling that you get when you're reading a great mystery novel and you have to turn the page, or when you're eating potato chips or crisps. You want one more. So I think the art of creating a great documentary beginning is the art of seduction. You are pulling people in through a great control of your craft and material.
Writing for, you know, literature has its favorites and its award winners and its Nobel laureates, and I think maybe audio, somehow we don't have the names on the top of our, you know, the tip of our tongue as to who are the best audio storytellers in the world. Is this something that's changing?
Yeah, I really do think, I think you're right about that. For example, most arts and media are reviewed. There's very little reviewing of the audio world, for example. That's changing with the podcast world. But absolutely, I think they're beginning to be people who are very well known, whose style is well known in the United States. Obviously, Ira Glass from This American Life and Jed Abumrad from Radiolab are quite well known, and then people like the people who make Serial, and there are more and more. And I think that's really great. It gives people, you know, it's something to aspire to. The only disadvantage is that there are a lot of copycats.
On the platform question, I ask, you know, should it even be a question that's been asked still? Radio versus on demand over the internet, online podcast. Like, people kind of pore over whether radio is an industry and podcasting is emerging, and did podcasting kill the radio star and this kind of stuff. Is the platform question a done question? Is it spent?
No, I think it's a good question. I think it's that story's still unfolding, especially in places like America, where there's been like multi-million dollar investment with people trying to make money from it. And so it's beginning to diverge from public radio model. It's a good question. You know, my most of my career was with public radio, and I some of it live, some of it taped and packaged. I see advantages in the podcast platform, which is ease of entry, diversity of voices, low barrier for people who would have to beat down the door to get into the main broadcasters. Now their issues are they're different issues. They're finding an audience. On the other hand, there are some things that are being done in podcasts that are absolutely the same as what you might find on radio. You know, I don't think there's anything particularly innovative about an interview show. Yeah.
Is this something that academia should turn its attention to, podcasting over radio? I don't think there's much radio research happening except in history. Should academia be looking to podcasting as a new emerging way of expressing ourselves?
I think it's beginning to happen. In Australia, at the University of, I think it's Wollongong, there's the Radio Doc Review, which is run by an Irish expat, Siobhan McHugh, who's now an academic. So this is taking the critical analysis of radio documentaries, and people from the English-speaking world are reviewing and analyzing documentaries, not only English-speaking documentaries. It's beginning to happen. I think it's emerging. But I'm not speaking with a great deal of authority on that. I'm not part of that academic world.
Outside of the English-speaking world, you mentioned France. Is there a growing podcast world in the French-speaking language?
From what I understand, but I'm not part of that, so I don't know much about it, to be honest.
And just on your thoughts on the festival itself, how are you finding it?
Oh, I love it. To me, these festivals work on two levels. One is the personal connection, meeting people who are like-minded, who are doing things that you might be interested in or discover. So that all happens outside of the sessions. And then the sessions are like a chocolate box. You know, you have such an enormous variety. You could go to performance, you could go to pieces about craft, you could things that blur boundaries in terms of the media. So I think that it really works wonderfully well, and the setting's lovely, and people are super hospitable here.
You'll be coming back?
Yes, this is the third time I've been here. I missed the 2017 one, but I was here in 2014, 2015. Absolutely, this is a mark on the calendar event.
Neil, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm with Peregrine Andrews, and you've just given a talk about the sound of sport.
Absolutely, and Sound of Sport refers to a documentary I made in 2011, actually, which then became, I made it for the BBC, and then it became a very popular podcast.
And sound, I didn't really, before I heard this talk, realize that it has a unique kind of audio fingerprint that's going on, that we become accustomed to, and it kind of softens us into our armchair to watch that sport.
it does, and we don't think about it. We just accept it. I mean, the sound of various sports is sort of ingrained in us, isn't it? The sort of hush of Wimbledon when they tap, you know, that anticipation before they serve. Football crowds, obviously. and we take it for granted. We don't really think about how these sounds actually get captured.
Funny you should mention the tennis, because there is anticipation and there's silence in the build-up. Mm. Is silence being squeezed out of broadcast sport?
Well, certainly it hasn't in tennis, and in fact, I didn't play this in my talk, but I did cover tennis quite a lot in the program, and one of the things that a sound supervisor who does a lot of tennis did say is that hush is such an important part, and that actually they play with a lot of dynamic range, so they really do try and keep that hush like a very still moment of anticipation, and then you'll get this enormous swell of the crowd, but they try not to sort of squeeze the dynamics so that you still get that huge sense of variation.
You said it's invisible in the mix. Is it something that has a huge amount of people working on it, or is it a small amount of experts who know exactly what they're doing?
I think it depends on the sport. I mean, I think football. I mean, I'm no expert on this because I don't actually do that professionally. I mean, the Olympics is an enormous team, huge team, hundreds and hundreds of people. Probably something like the Oxford and Cambridge boat race is probably half a dozen people. Football matches maybe slightly fewer because they can use maybe a fixed rig of mics. Those are football's probably a little simpler, although maybe a really big game isn't. But for something like the Olympics, it's an enormous team.
Is it something that producers give a lot of thought to before they kind of go to the live day?
I think they do now. I think it's become such a big part of it, actually. That when you marry the two together, the fantastic pictures and these very rich, complicated, detailed mixes, you know, you get something that's fantastically entertaining.
Your documentary kind of finishes with the fakery that might be going on, is going on in sound. And I think, are you kind of comfortable with that yourself?
Well, we call it fakery, but it's really problem solving. It's really filling in situations where there's no practical way to get what you might call the right sound. And so, okay, technically it's a slight cheat in that you might introduce a pre-recorded sound because the natural sound has got a helicopter covered all over it, the helicopter being necessary because you've got a camera which has to capture the shots of the rowing boat, and the rowing boat doesn't make very much noise. And so as a viewer, what do you want to see? What do you want to hear when you watch a boat? You want to hear a boat. And the only way you can do that practically in the face of that much noise from a helicopter is to introduce a pre-recorded sound of a boat.
Until silent drones come along and solve that problem.
Absolutely.
And where is it all going? Is there any new technological advances beyond drones? Like, is this going into video games, and are people in sport lending themselves to the virtual world?
I think the two sort of feeding into each other, which is something I find very interesting. I mean, video games have a lot of people play them, and a lot of people play video game versions of traditional sports, but the video game versions have lots of very detailed sounds and very dramatic sounds, and that builds expectations. And then when people watch live sport, they sort of expect that live sport to be just as exciting. So the two actually feed forward and back into each other.
Peregrine Andrews, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Flirt FM, and it's Wireless. We are at the Hearsay Audio Arts Festival 2019, and I'm talking with Brian of the Uncooperative Collaborator.
Yeah, hello, nice to be here, thanks very much.
You work with Jesse, you've just done a performance, we've just had a little listen to the sound of it. Tell us, why do you do this?
Well, to explore different things. It's an artistic performance, so it's just interesting to explore. We're exploring technology, and we're exploring technologies place in the world, and we're creating interesting sounds, and it's interesting above all things, that's why.
Here on Wireless we talk about analog v digital and its mix going forward, coming back from digital to analog, which one outlives the other and the importances of it. Your piece is very much about the analog and the digital, analog inputs, digital conversion, analog outputs. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, you could see it as analog versus digital, as a performance piece. So it's basically three of us collaborating. There's myself, there's Jesse, and there's a plant, a pineapple plant, which is encased in a tetrahedron of perspex and hooked up to wires. It's got sensors in it that can turn it into a musical instrument itself, so it's able to play musical instruments through a computer.
Why, I asked you, and you said art, what do you learn from it?
That's a good question.
You learn how to solder and you learn a bit about electronics.
Yeah, I think you learn how to play as well, you know, to just enjoy it and try and experience something, experiment with something. I mean, the other element, the analog element, is an analog synthesizer that I built myself. So I learned a lot through doing that, and it always surprises me. And I think the question we had when myself and Jesse started working on this is, do these things have their own intelligence within them? Is there sentience there? You know, can you give a plant agency in society to act? Does a synthesizer have its own character or its own voice that it's trying to come out? And I think that's what we've discovered, is that the answer is yes, because when you start playing the synthesizer, you're learning to play this new instrument that has never been seen before, and it's interacting in unusual ways. And definitely sometimes the sounds that come out of it, you think, you're just like, well, this thing has a mind of its own. So, I mean, the answer is yes, you know.
Are you modulating your guitar synthesizer through an old wireless radio?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's an old Valve radio, an old Philips one, which is, it sounds really nice. The synthesizer goes through it, and I was delighted to use that as the speaker, and we mic that up then during a performance. It adds a lot to the sound, and I like the aesthetic of it as well.
You found that in a skip discarded.
That's true, yeah. On the way up to my studio in Sample Studios in Cork, I saw it in a skip, and I thought, that's never going to work, but it looks cool, maybe I can do something with it. But actually, when I got it up to the studio and opened it up, there was just a couple of wires off, so I fixed it up basically and got it working, and it did become part of the performance, but not in the way I had initially thought when I saw it lying there.
Musically, at the crescendo of what you just played, it sounded very similar to a modem dialing up in 1995. Is that accident, or is there influence there?
yeah. There's certainly influence there. I think as a sound artist, you're influenced by all the things that you hear, and that was certainly something you heard when you accidentally picked up the phone and, you know, someone was on the internet back in the day, and you might knock them off. You'd be thinking, oh, whoops, I better put it back down again. So
it's not a recording of that. You've actually achieved that sound through all the inputs kind of harmonizing and getting to that state.
Yeah, exactly. There's no recording. It's all made live. So that's Jesse's part of it. He's used Maxim SP to program digital instruments. And basically the plant is playing those instruments by the signals that are generated within it, its own electrical signals, because it's a living thing. Yeah.
Many thanks, Brian. Kraftwerk, eat your heart out.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's coming. Thank you.
Brian Leach of the Uncooperative Collaborator Sound Performance speaking to Brian Green at the Hearsay International Audio Festival in Limerick recently. Hearsay has been warmly welcomed by the community of Kilfinan and surrounding areas, so Brian also sought out the opinions of local people, including Noel Amy, owner of the Village Inn in Ballyorgan.
Tell us, what do you think of the festival this weekend?
Fantastic, really. You know, it's great to see so many people around and all different ideas and different voices, I suppose, different accents. And good as a local to see loads of lovely people, all different shapes and sizes, coming in and just talking to each other and listening to people and listening to everything, really, you know. And we hadn't a clue really what it was about at the start, but when you just come in and just sit down and go into different things, it doesn't really matter. You just walk in and you get the gist. Sometimes you don't know, sometimes you kind of say, what's that about? But after a while you get the gist of what you take out of it. Anyway, I don't know, maybe it's the wrong gist, but it's lovely. And were just at one there a while ago now where there is just a drawing. One guy was drawing and the other guy was telling the story, and there was music in the background, and oh, it was amazing, yeah.
What does it mean for Kilfinan and Ballyorgan and Kilmallock? Like, it must put a boost, a shot of adrenaline into the area, is it?
Yeah, yeah, it's great, great buzz around the place, and it brings in a bit of money too. It's great. As a businesswoman, I have a small pub up in Ballyorgan, and I've had all these people during the week and sustain the holiday homes, and you know, they come back. Their Vale has been here 2 years ago, and Daniel and Maria from Copenhagen, and you know, they're friends now, as well as, you know, people coming and just turning up at a festival, and we get to know them and they get to know us and they get to know the area, and just we live in one of the most beautiful villages in Ireland, and I can say that with confidence. It's just gorgeous.
Last question, is it my imagination, or are the people that have come here really, really pleasant and nice and friendly?
No, it's not your imagination at all. They're just lovely people, interested in their niche of sound and audio and making stuff for radio. Jesus, radio is brilliant. Sure, everyone listens. Everyone in Ireland, I think, listens to the radio. We're radio people because it's in the car, it's in the house, you know, and even though there's, I suppose, Netflix and all that, still people always listen to the radio. Brilliant. So I think that's our connection, and that's why we like it so much, you know.
Nuala Mee of the Village Inn in Ballyorgan, finishing that report by Brian Green from the Hearsay International Audio Festival. You can find out more at hearsayfestival.ie, and we're looking forward already to the next one.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
This is the last programme in the current series of Wireless on Flirt FM, so we thought we'd return to one of our highlights of the show over the past year. In October 2018, the annual Craol Féile of Community Radio was held in Athlone in County Westmeath. Our welcoming hosts were Athlone Community Radio, and I caught up with one of the station's busy staff, Irena Jack Cvetkovic, who came from Serbia to Ireland in the 1990s and has worked in community radio here ever since. Here's a flavour of Irena's story.
It is almost 19 years. I come here in 2000, long, long time ago.
And what inspired you to get involved in community radio in Ireland?
Well, I have journalism, BA in journalism, and I thought I will never, ever kind of work as a journalist in some other country on my second language. And I was like, what will I do? So while I was doing a practice for some computer course, I chose Roscommon Community Radio. So just to be around, like to see how the media works. And I heard about this Sound and Vision that is the funding for radio documentaries. And although I did have my practice in TV back home, back in Serbia, in Belgrade, like I never actually work on radio, so it was a big challenge for me. So I was successful, and I was doing then just not, I was not there just to do database, you know, like kind of, I was there to kind of make a program for Ross FM. And then I met a few people there, and few of us from Roscommon actually set up the radio station in Athlone, because we were all Athlonians, and then we really, like from infancy, like from the beginning, we set up the community radio, and I'm with Athlone Community Radio since the first public meetings 11, 12 years ago.
And obviously then the ethos of community radio is really important for you. What does it mean to you?
I didn't know about, like, kind of, I think Ireland has a different and other, even in Europe, it's even recognized through Broadcasting Act that there is like community radio, community media, and that they're independent, and they're kind of certain radios that they are covering. But there's this ethos, which is very important. We believe that there is no big stars, and everyone can do loads of things at the radio. Everyone has a story to tell and great voice, and we find something for everyone. You can just do the research, or you can just do a technical thing. And it's, I think, the widest the wider mix of people that you can meet anywhere. And if you talk about community development or anything that you can help benefit the community, like you think about community radio, because where else, look at yourself, you're a lecturer who is in community radio. We have a psychotherapist who was there. We have an urban planner who is there. We had someone from active age group. We have someone who is recovered alcoholic, like kind of. We have kids from transition years. Like where else you can meet kind of that kind of, it's such an interesting and absolutely very creative environment, lively, dynamic. It's just great.
And one of the most creative things you've been doing has been documentary making. You've made a lot of documentaries. You've spoken to us at the Creil Fela today and yesterday about those documentaries. So can you tell us about your experience of that, and how did you get into documentary making? How have you become such a proficient documentary maker?
Oh, God. Well, I think it helped me my journalism background. So this kind of, idea, okay, research, you know, that all helps you in it. And I think, you know, it's always your own personality, your drive, you know, you want to tell a story. As I said, documentaries, storytelling, I love that. And I just, you know, like kind of when I think of something, it's important to say, and I like the creative process of getting an angle to it and how to tell the story. So one of my first one, and I just look around and have an idea. So being in Athlone, but actually the local historian told me, we need a girl from Serbia to come to Athlone and actually make a program about Gentex, John Cantmacorum, John Broderick, Athlone calling my drum, because people are here, take that for granted. And I, coming from outside, I said, you have the world famous tenor, like kind of, you have a writer that was banned and gay, and you have the first radio mast, and no one up till now make a documentary. So that
do you think, is it your outsider status that makes you more aware of what's happening in a place like this?
Yeah. Well, I think they all got used to it. Like, I heard about Gentex, like kind of, Gentex is such a popular documentary because the people from all over the world who ever had any connection with Athlone, it's such a local story, but everyone, because could you imagine that time in 1930s that the one enterprise in any town in Ireland and not in Athlone that at that time have like 12,000 people, 1,000 people work in a textile industry.
So Gentex was a textile industry.
Gentex, a textile industry that has a put up from the old wool mills that was on the Shannon in Athlone. Yeah. But then they start, but it's such a lovely story because it's a story about, you know, it's what Guinness was for Dublin, that was Gentex for the whole area. So everyone was working there, but it's such a camaraderie there. Like at that time, like people lived differently, respect was different, and it's such a great story. And everyone has someone in the family who work in Gentex. That's why it's such a popular documentary from people all over the world is actually going back to Gentex.
Irena Jack-Cvetkovic of Athlone Community Radio speaking about her passion for radio and for documentaries last October at the Creil Fela of Community Radio. And since we spoke, Irena has become manager of Athlone Community Radio, so we wish her the very best in her new role. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3, and indeed to the end of this series of the programme. We'll be back in September with a new series bringing you news and features about radio and sound from Ireland and abroad. I hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us over the summer on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/Wireless Flirt. Until the next edition of Wireless in September, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.